Before the Golden Bough had made her offing from Good Hope and come onto her true course to round the Cape, Captain Christopher Llewellyn was already regretting having taken on board his paying passenger. He had found out soon enough that Colonel Cornelius Schroeder was a difficult man to like, arrogant, outspoken, and highly opinionated. He held firm and unwavering views on every subject that was raised, and was never diffident in giving expression to these. "He picks up enemies as a dog picks up fleas," Llewellyn told his mate. The second day out from Table Bay, Llewellyn had invited Schroeder to dine with him and some of his officers in the stern cabin. He was a cultured man, and maintained a grand style even at sea. With the prize money that he had won in the recent Dutch War, he could afford to indulge his taste for fine things. The Golden Bough had cost almost £2,000 to build and launch, but she was probably the finest vessel of her class and burden afloat. Her culverins were newly cast, and her sails were of the finest canvas. The captain's quarters were fitted out with a taste and discrimination unparalleled in any navy, but her qualities as a fighting ship had not been sacrificed for luxury. During the voyage down the Atlantic, Llewellyn had found, to his delight, that her sea-keeping qualities were all he had hoped. On a broad reach, with her sails full and the wind free, her hull sliced through the water like a blade, and she could point so high into the wind that it made his heart sing to feel her deck heel under his feet. Most of his officers and petty officers had served with him during the war and had proved their quality and courage, but he had on board one younger officer, the fourth son of George, Viscount Winterton. Lord Winterton was the master navigator of the order, one of the richest and most powerful men in England. He owned a fleet of privateers and trading ships. The Honourable Vincent Winterton was on his first privateering voyage, placed by his father under Llewellyn's tutelage. He was a comely youth, not yet 20 years of age, but well educated, with a frank and winning manner that made him popular with both the seamen and his brother officers alike. He was one of the other guests at Llewellyn's dinner table, that second night out from Good Hope. The dinner started out gay and lively, for all the Englishmen were merry, with a fine ship under them and the promise of glory and gold ahead. Schroeder, however, was aloof and gloomy. With the second glass of wine warming them all, Llewellyn called across the cabin, "Vincent, my lad, will you not give us a tune?" "Could you bear to listen yet again to my caterwauling, sir?" The young man laughed modestly, but the rest of the company urged him on. "Come on, Vinny, sing for us, man!" Vincent Winterton stood up and went to the small clavichord that was fastened with heavy brass screws to one of the main frames of the ship. He sat down, tossed back his long, thick, curling locks, and struck a soft, silvery chord from the keyboard. "What would you have me sing?" "Greensleeves," suggested someone, but Vincent pulled a face. "Oh, you've heard that 100 times and more since we sailed from home." "Mother mine," cried another. This time Vincent nodded, threw back his head, and sang in a strong, true voice that transformed the mawkish lyrics and brought tears to the eyes of many of the company as they tapped their feet in time to the song. Schroeder had taken an immediate and unreasoned dislike to the attractive youth, so comely and popular with his peers, so sure of himself and serene in his high rank and privileged birth. Schroeder, in comparison, felt himself aging and overlooked. He had never attracted the natural admiration and affection of those about him, as this young man so obviously did. He sat stiffly in a corner, ignored by these men, who not so long ago had been his deadly enemies, and who, he knew, despised him as a dull foreigner and a foot soldier, not one of their elite brotherhood of the ocean. He found his dislike turning into active hatred of the young man, whose fine features were clear and unlined, and whose voice had the timbre and tonal colour of a temple bell. When the song ended, there was a moment of silence, attentive and awed. Then they all burst out clapping and applauding. "Oh, well done, lad, and bravo, Vinny!" Schroeder felt his irritation become unbearable. The applause went on too long for the liking of the singer, and Vincent rose from the clavichord with a deprecating wave of the hand that begged them to desist. In the silence that followed, Schroeder said, softly but distinctly, "Caterwauling?" "No, sir. That was an insult to the feline species. There was a shocked silence in the small cabin. The young man flushed, and his hand dropped instinctively to the hilt of the short-bladed dirk that he wore in his jeweled belt. But Llewellyn said sharply, "Vincent!" and shook his head. Reluctantly, he dropped his hand from the weapon and forced himself to smile and bow slightly. "You have a perceptive ear, sir. I commend your discerning taste." He resumed his seat at the board and turned away from Schroeder to engage his neighbour in light-hearted repartee. The awkward moment passed and the other guests relaxed, smiled and joined in the conversation, which pointedly excluded the colonel. Llewellyn's cook had come with him from home, and the ship had been provisioned at Good Hope with fresh meat and vegetables. The meal was as good as any that might be served in the coffee shops and alehouses of Fleet Street, the conversation as pleasing and the banter nimble and amusing, larded with clever puns, double meanings, and fashionable slang. Most of this was above Schroeder's grasp of the language, and his resentment built up like the brewing of a tropical typhoon. He made one contribution to the conversation, a stinging reference to the Dutch victory in the Thames River and the capture of the Royal Charles, the pride of the English Navy and the namesake of their beloved sovereign. The conversation froze into silence once more, and the company fixed him with chilly scrutiny before continuing their conversation as though he had not spoken. Schroeder consoled himself with the claret, and when the bottle in front of him was exhausted, he reached down the table for a flagon of brandy. His head for liquor was as adamantine as his pride. But today it seemed only to make him more truculent and angry. By the end of the meal he was spoiling for trouble, and prospecting for some way in which to ease the terrible sense of rejection and hopelessness that overpowered him. At last Llewellyn stood up to propose the loyal toast. "Here's health and a long life to the black boy!" Everyone rose enthusiastically to their feet, stooping under the low deck timbers overhead. But Schroeder stayed seated. Llewellyn knocked on the table. "If you please, Colonel, come to your feet. We are drinking the health of the King of England." "I am no longer thirsty, thank you, Captain." Schroeder folded his arms. The men growled. One said loudly, "Let me at him, Captain." "Colonel Schroeder is a guest aboard this ship," Llewellyn said ominously. "And none of you will offer him any discourtesy, no matter if he behaves like a pig himself and transgresses all the conventions of decent society." Then he turned back to Schroeder. "Colonel, I am asking you for the last time to join the loyal toast. If you do not, we are still within easy range of Good Hope. I will give the orders immediately for the ship to go about and sail back to Table Bay. There I will return your fair money to you and have you deposited on the beach like a bucket full of kitchen slops." Schroeder sobered instantly. This was a threat he had not anticipated. He had hoped to provoke one of these English oafs into a duel. He would then have given them a display of swordsmanship that would have opened their cold fish eyes and wiped those superior smirks from their faces. But the thought of being taken back to the scene of his crime and delivered into the vengeful hands of Governor Van der Velde made his lips go numb and his fingers tingle with dread. He rose slowly to his feet with his glass in his hand. Llewellyn relaxed slightly. They all drank the toast and sat down again in a hubbub of laughter and talk. "Does anybody fancy a few throws of the dice?" Vincent Winston suggested, and there was general agreement. "But not if you wish to play for shilling stakes again," one of the older officers demurred. "Last time I lost almost £20, all the prize money I won when we captured the Burman." "Farthing stakes and a shilling limit," another suggested, and they nodded and felt for their purses. "Mr. Winterton, sir," Schroeder broke in, "I will oblige you with whatever stakes your stomach will hold and not puke up again." He was pale, and sweat sheened his forehead, but that was the only visible effect the liquor had upon him. Once again a silence fell on the table as Schroeder groped under his tunic and brought out a pigskin purse. He dropped it nonchalantly on the table, and it clinked with the unmistakable music of gold. Every man at the table stiffened. "We play in sport and in good fellowship here," Llewellyn growled. But Vincent Winterton said lightly, "How much is in that purse, Colonel?" Schroeder loosened the drawstring, and with a flourish poured the coins into a heavy heap in the centre of the table where they sparkled in the lamplight. Triumphantly he looked around the circle of their faces. "They will not take me so lightly now," he thought. But aloud he said, 20,000 Dutch guilders. That is over 200 of your English pounds." It was his entire fortune. But there was a reckless, self-destructive pounding in his heart. He found himself driven on to folly, as though he might wipe away the guilt of his terrible murder with gold. The company was silenced by the size of his purse. It was an enormous sum, more than most of these officers might expect to accumulate in a lifetime of dangerous endeavour. Vincent Winterton smiled graciously. "I see, you are indeed a sportsman, sir."
"Ah, so," Schroeder smiled coldly. "The stakes are too high, are they?"
And he swept the golden coins back into his purse and made as if to rise from the table. "Hold hard, Colonel," Vincent stopped him. And Schroeder sank back into his seat. "I came unprepared, but if you will afford me a few minutes of your time..." He rose, bowed, and left the cabin. They all sat in silence until he returned and placed a small teak chest in front of him on the table. 300, was it?" He began to count out the coins from the chest. They made a splendid profusion in the centre of the table. "Will you be kind enough to hold the stakes, Captain?" Vincent asked politely. "That is, if the Colonel agrees."
"I have no objection."
Schroeder nodded stiffly and passed his purse to Llewellyn. Inwardly, the first regrets were assailing him. He had not expected any of them to take up his challenge. A loss of such magnitude must beggar most men, as indeed it would beggar him. Llewellyn received both purses and placed them before him. Then Vincent took up the leather dice cup and passed it across to Schroeder.
"We usually play with these, sir," Vincent said easily. "Would you care to examine them? If they are not to your liking, perhaps we may be able to find others that suit you better."
Schroeder shook the dice out of the cup and rolled them across the table. Then he picked up each ivory cube and held it to the lamplight.
"I can see no blemish," he said, and replaced them in the cup. "It remains only to agree to game. Will it be hazard?"
"English hazard," Vincent agreed. "What else?"
"What limit on each coup?" Schroeder wanted to know. "Will it be a pound or five?"
"A single coup only," said Vincent. "The shooter to be decided by high dice, and then £200 on his hazard."
Schroeder was stunned by the proposal. He had expected to make his wagers in small increments, which would allow him the possibility of withdrawing with some semblance of grace if the run of dice turned against him. He had never heard of such an immense sum staked on a single throw of the dice.
One of Vincent's friends chortled delightedly.
"By God's truth, Vinny, that'll show up the colour of the cheese head's liver."
Schroeder glared at him, but he knew he was trapped. For a moment longer he sought some escape, but Vincent murmured, "I do hope I've not embarrassed you, Colonel. I mistook you for a sport. Would you rather call off the whole affair?"
"I assure you," he said coldly, "that it suits me very well. One hazard for £200. I agree."
Llewellyn placed one of the dice in the cup and passed it to Schroeder.
"One die to decide the shooter? High shoots? Is that your agreement, gentlemen?"
Both men nodded. Schroeder rolled the single die.
"Three," said Llewellyn, and replaced it in the leather cup.
"Your throw, Mr. Winterton." He placed the cup in front of Vincent, who swept it up and threw in the same motion.
"Five," said Llewellyn. "Mr. Winterton is the shooter at one cup of the English hazard for a purse of £200.
This time he placed both dice in the cup.
"The shooter will throw to decide the main point. If you please, Mr. Winterton."
Vincent took up the cup and rolled it out. Llewellyn read the dice.
"The main is seven."
Schroeder's soul quailed. Seven was the easiest main to duplicate. Many combinations of the dice would yield it. The odds had swung against him. And this realization was reflected on the gloating face of every one of the watchers. If Vincent threw another seven or an 11, he would win.
which was likely. If he threw the crabs 1 and 1, or 1 and 2, or if he threw 12, then he lost. Any other number would become his chance, and he would have to keep throwing until he repeated it or threw one of the losing combinations. Schroeder leaned back and folded his arms as though to defend himself from a brutal attack. Vincent threw. 4, said Llewellyn. The chance is now 4. There was a simultaneous release of breath from every person at the table except Vincent. He had given himself the most difficult main to achieve. The odds had swung back overwhelmingly in Schroeder's favour. Vincent must now throw a chance 4 to win or a main 7 to lose. Only 2 combinations could total 4, whereas there were many others that would yield a losing 7. You have my sympathy, sir, Schroeder smiled cruelly. 4 is de devil's own number to make. The angels favour the virtuous. Vincent waved his hand lightly and smiled. Would you care to increase your stake? I will give you even money for another £100. It was a foolhardy offer, with the odds stacked heavily against him. But Schroeder had not another guilder to avail himself of it. He shook his head curtly. I would not take advantage of a man who is on his knees. How gallant you are, Colonel, Vincent said, and threw again. 10, said Llewellyn. It was a neutral number. Vincent picked up the dice and rattled them in the cup and threw again. 6, another neutral number, and though Schroeder sat still as a corpse, his colour was waxen, and he could feel droplets of sweat crawling through his chest hairs like slimy garden slugs. "This one is for all the pretty girls we left behind us," said Vincent, and the dice clattered on the walnut table-top as he threw again. For a long, terrible moment no man moved or spoke. Then a howl went up from every English throat that must have alarmed the watch on the deck above and reached to the lookout at the top of the mainmast. "Mary and Joseph, 2 pairs of titties! As sweet a little 4 as I ever have seen!" "Mr. Winterton has thrown his chance," intoned Llewellyn, and placed both heavy purses in front of him. "Mr. Winterton wins." But his voice was almost drowned by the uproar of laughter and congratulation. It went on for several minutes, while Schroeder sat immobile as a fallen forest log, his face grey and sweating. At last Winterton waved away any further chaff and congratulation. He stood up, leaned over the table towards Schroeder, and said seriously, "I salute you, sir. You are a gentleman of iron nerve and a sportsman of the first water. I offer you the hand of friendship." He stretched out his right hand with the palm open. Schroeder looked at it disdainfully, still not moving, and the smiles faded away. Another charged silence fell over the little cabin. Schroeder spoke out clearly. "I should have examined those dice of yours more closely while I had the chance." He placed a heavy emphasis on the possessive pronoun. "I hope you'll forgive me, sir, but I make it a rule never to shake hands with cheats." Vincent recoiled sharply and stared at Schroeder in disbelief, while the others gasped and gaped. It took Vincent a long moment to recover from the shock of the unexpected insult, and his handsome young face had paled under his sea and salt-tanned skin as he replied, "I would be deeply obliged if you could see fit to accord me satisfaction with that remark, Colonel Schroeder." "With the greatest of pleasure," Schroeder rose to his feet, smiling with triumph. He had been challenged, so the choice of weapons was his. There would be no aping about with pistols. It would be the steel, and this English puppy would have the pleasure of a yard of the Neptune sword in his belly. Schroeder turned to Llewellyn. "Would you do me the honour of acting as my second in this matter?" he asked. "Not I," Llewellyn shook his head firmly. "I will not allow dueling on any ship of mine. You will have to find yourself another person to act for you, and you will have to check your temper until we reach port. Then you can go ashore to settle this matter." Schroeder looked back at Vincent. "I will inform you of the name of my second at the first opportunity," he said. "I promise you satisfaction as soon as we reach the port." He stood up and marched out of the cabin. He could hear their voices behind him, raised in comment and conjecture. But the brandy fumes rose to mingle with his rage, until he feared the veins beating in his temple might burst with the strength of it.